When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Greetings, everyone. Welcome, and thanks for tuning in to the Adventures Out There podcast. What is up, everyone? This is Andy Neal, and you're listening to the podcast that asks people who have gone on some sort of adventure, whether it's in the outdoors or whether it's career-wise or whether just doing amazing things creatively or just amazing people, how their adventure has changed them and how they're changing the world around them. You are listening to the Adventures Out There podcast, sponsored by no one, except maybe there might have been a pre-roll ad because Spotify does that now. I get a little bit of kickback for that because, you know, yeah, it's nice. Anyways, all, thank you so much for listening. We are back, and I am super excited about this conversation, which was recorded back in November. My friend Dara Blackwater, we have, this is the third time I've had a interview with her, and we talked back in November. And then my life went crazy after that. If you've been following me on Instagram at Andy Films and Hikes, you know I've had a lot of family stuff trying to help my kids get the mental health services they need here in Oregon. And it was just like every time I planned on getting this out and just recording this intro and recording this outro and putting it out, something would happen. Anyways, we're back at it, obviously. I talked with Dara earlier this week, messaged her and was like, are you still cool with this going out a few months later? I think life has changed a lot for both of us. But just take that when you listen to this episode, take that with a grain of salt. This is a few months old, the conversation, but it is like an hour and a half long conversation. We talked about everything about, let me give you Dara's, biography. Dara Blackwater is from Farmington, New Mexico, is a citizen of the Navajo Nation. She is a conceptual artist and attorney specializing in indigenous law and telecommunications law. In a previous career, she was a tennis professional at the John Newcomb Tennis Ranch in New Braunfels, Texas, and in, I can't pronounce this, it's in China. While in China, Dara and her walking partner, Ann Ling, walked 1,388 miles from Zhonghan to Beijing to raise money for organizations that empower people with disabilities. She spent a year of law school working on tribal issues in Washington, D.C., and has assisted in building multiple community networks in indigenous communities. Dara has extensively researched and written about the concept of spectrum sovereignty, which we'll talk more about, the idea that Native nations have exclusive rights to electromagnetic spectrum on and over their lands. Dara spent her summer after law school hiking the Colorado Trail to raise awareness about the digital divide and indigenous issues. Her Native Lens video on indigenous spectrum sovereignty is featured in the National Museum of Natural History exhibit, and I will link that in the description of this episode, through 2025. In her spare time, she can be found playing tennis, making art, and playing in the mountains. And this is the third time she's been on the show. We talked for an hour and a half about the outdoors, spectrum sovereignty. Both of us are formerly evangelical Christians, and we talked about that and our history and perspective of that. There's a reason why she's been on three times. We have amazing conversations, and I am so honored to have Dara Blackwater back on the show again. So I'm just going to shut up, and without any further ado, my conversation from last November, where we also did talk about Killers of the Flower Moon, the film, and our thoughts on it, and how Lily Gladwell should win the Oscar, and spoiler alert, she didn't. I'm still not happy about that because I saw all the movies nominated for that category and she should have won. But we talked about that as well. But without any further ado, say it again, my conversation with Dara Blackwater. So I think this is the third time you've been on the show.
Dara? Is it the third? I thought it was the second.
I know I've had you on. I've had you on early on when the Hiker podcast first started, and then not too long ago, Because I remember the first one, I had a thumbnail with you. You said you were on the Colorado Trail with a sign about being on Ute land. And
yeah.
Then the second one you had thumbnail. I remember everything by thumbnails. It was the painting of you.
Yeah. My friend Warren did that.
Yeah. So this is the third time, I think.
Okay, sweet. I'll take your word for it. I love being on every time I've been on. So yeah, third time.
I love having you on. And it's funny. And I say this in the best way possible. When I have you on is when I lose the most followers and listeners.
Really?
Which I love, because it gets rid of like the people who don't want to take what's being said seriously, and they get like easily offended. And I'm like, yes. And I want you to take that like in the best as a compliment.
Because that's just so interesting.
Every time it's like, oh wow, okay, people don't like it when we're talking about things like, you know, being on Indigenous land and you know, land acknowledgements and other things like that, like the history of this nation. People are just like, that makes me uncomfortable. I'm not going to follow Andy or the Hiker podcast right now. It's the Adventures Out There podcast, which I love, because it's like they're just listening to feel good, which I love being positive and stuff, but there are things that just, there's no way to sugarcoat some things. So
yeah, and to reframe it a bit, like the truth can be positive, right? Yeah. I don't think that it has to be a negative thing to acknowledge these things, but that's what you're saying, is that if it's perceived that way, then we don't want you here.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, on the flip side of that, when I posted, you know, asking people if they had any questions for our conversation today, some of my favorite people who follow me were like, oh, that's how I found you the first time, was because awesome. You were on Andy's podcast. And I was like, that's so cool, because they're some of my favorite people. Yeah.
I love that. Well, for people who don't know who you are, or maybe are just now listening to the podcast, go ahead and just introduce yourself and we'll get into it.
Cool. So my name is Dara Blackwater. For my fellow Diné listeners, she'e Dara Blackwater dasha Diné, besh bechain nishle do zina jini bashish chin ado besh bechai dasha che do tach ine dashnelli. I am a citizen of the Navajo Nation. I am originally from Farmington, New Mexico, which is a border town on the edge of the Navajo Nation. And I'm an attorney. I'm a consultant. I play tennis. I hike. I am an advocate for Indigenous peoples, and I really like mashed potatoes.
All right. Thank you so much for coming on. I've said it before. I feel like we have this weird kinship with coming from completely different backgrounds, but both of us, you know, grew up in like evangelical church a bit, and we've always had this cool like connection. I just love talking to you, and I've learned so much just from our conversations, both online and here in person. Obviously this is online too, but so what have you been up to?
Well, same first, I always enjoy our conversations. I am starting a business. I was working for the Department of Interior, which is basically the agency in our government, for anyone who doesn't know, that houses like the national parks, the Bureau of Land Management, the Bureau of Water Reclamation, and then also, well, lots of other things, but also the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Bureau of Indian Education are kind of under Interior. And there is a Native woman at the helm of Interior right now. It's Deb Holland, who's from the Laguna Pueblo in New Mexico. So it's a really interesting organization, started in the mid 1800s. And I was working for them for a year as an attorney. I got barred. And so now I'm a licensed attorney in New Mexico, which I wasn't ever sure that I thought I was going to say, because it was such a terrible process to become a licensed attorney. But I am. And then I just quit that job with Interior, and I am starting a consulting business called Blackwater Consulting. And I'm doing all the things that I want to do. I'm working on more artwork. I'm about to get my own podcast up and running again. And I am helping organizations work with Indigenous peoples better, which is exactly what I want to be doing.
So there's been a lot of press lately about Indigenous peoples with Martin Scorsese's new film. And I wanted to get into that a little bit because I saw it. I spent 4 hours on Sunday to see that. Flowers of the Black Moon.
Killers of the Flower Moon. Yeah, yeah.
And I have opinions about it. I know we've talked and you have opinions about it, but there's been just a lot of talk about that I've noticed online. I wanted to get into that a little bit because you've made some pretty bold statements about that, which I would say I pretty much agree with after seeing the film. But let's talk about that a little bit and then just go from there. I think it's a good jumping
point. Can you start? Because I'm really interested in your thoughts and your impressions of it, having just seen it.
So the film, I saw it with two other filmmakers who've worked with Netflix and Nat Geo. And we, as far as the film goes, it was too long. It was too
It's long.
Yeah. I really thought it would have been better served as a series. If you really want to get into the nitty gritty of it, and really do it right, do it justice, would have been better served as, you know, a 5-6-part, 8-part series. And there were several parts where the cinematography I felt was just like, that doesn't make any sense. What's going on here? And we were talking with my friends and I afterwards, we were getting drinks afterwards. I'm like, we have our white lens we're watching this from. So, and we do know that Scorsese, consulted with the Osage tribe during the whole process, so maybe there's just things we weren't understanding about the format of the storytelling. But what pissed me off the most was the end. The radio show end, if you haven't listened.
If you haven't seen
the movie, spoiler. But essentially at the end, the whole thing is like a 1940s radio show where they're retelling the story, and there's all these white people, and then Scorsese comes out, which is jarring, like, oh, okay, and tells a story. And, you know, I could tell he, from watching interviews and things of that nature, that he really did have a deep connection to the story. He really wanted to tell the story. And he took it from the book, which was really more focused on the founding of the FBI, and did much more of an Osage focus on it, which is great. But I just was at the end of it, I'm like, that was not your story to tell, Scorsese. Like, it would have been much better told if you would have had, you know, ancestors of the people who were from the Osage Massacre tell that end story. And I just was like, it just didn't sit with me or the other people I was with right at the end, because it just took me way out of it. And I was like, so that in and of itself was just like, ugh. And then there was just lots of little like filmmaking things. I'm like, that was too long, that was too short. What, this character happened here, and then you just left it hanging. You didn't resolve this, you didn't resolve that. So I left, it's Scorsese. I'm excited that the story was being told and conversations are being had. But also, it was still very Scorsese in a lot of the gore and things that were shown, the violence that was shown. That's just what he does. And I think you said the same thing, which I wasn't like, you left not really feeling any, really understanding where are the Osage people now. Like, you never really understood that. And so I left was just like, oh, okay. I was just super frustrated with it. I was very excited about the story. I immediately started looking stuff up afterward. I mean, started reading as much as I could, which is great, which is with these kind of projects, I feel like that if that at least does that much, it's accomplished something. So that's where I was at with it. The end really did piss me off. Like, the whole radio show thing, I was just like, that just is not from a filmmaking perspective, but also from a cultural perspective. I didn't feel like that was, it made it a white man's story, I thought.
Yeah. That's my impression of the entire movie and the book. I think I said in my Instagram stories that I started reading the book. I went through a phase in law school, and even, I guess it was even before law school, that I was reading all, there's like a whole line of books about different tribes written by probably like boomer or maybe like older Gen X white men that mm-hmm. it's like Killers of the Flower Moon is one of them. The Comanche one, I forget, it's about Quanah Parker. I forget what it's called. And then like Blood and Thunder by Hampton Sides and a couple others. But those are, they're good books in the sense that they're very well researched and they focus on these interesting topics, but like they're very much not written obviously by or for Indigenous people. And they're really hard to read as an Indigenous person. Even like I have an interest in history, I have an interest in politics, but the way that a lot of those books are written are so gruesome. Mm. And like, this is probably the most intense one where I picked up the book and started reading it. And the gruesomeness of it, like specifically describing the violence against Native women, was just too much for me. And I was mm-hmm. like, I just don't want to read it. Like, I know it's an important part of history. I want to learn about it, but I can't sit and like create these images in my mind through reading the book. So I knew that it was going to be a hard thing to watch because just having like read a little bit of the book, I was like, I know that this is going to be really violent against people who look like me. And I said on Instagram, that's my least favorite part. Like I knew it was going to happen because Scorsese is Scorsese, but I just don't think that it's necessary or good. I think it kind of normalizes it. And even though it's shedding light on the problem, the origins, and well, not even the origins, because it'd been happening since, you know, it's mm-hmm. missing and murdered Indigenous women has been happening since colonization started. But, you know, this was heavily concentrated in a community. And so all of that to say that, like, I was thinking about Till, the movie Till, mm-hmm. and yeah. the director, who is a Black woman, who made a point to say, like, we are not showing violence against Black bodies in this film, even though, like, the story of Emmett Till is centered around violence against a Black boy. And so, like, thinking about that and how they made that powerful, amazing film, Till, without showing violence against Black bodies, and then looking at, like, this story and Scorsese just, like, leaning into violence against Native women's bodies, I was like, ugh, it just didn't have to be like this. And mm-hmm. if it was made by an Osage director, it wouldn't have looked anything like that. And it makes me thankful for Indigenous directors that we've seen doing such cool stuff recently, because like I leave so many of those films feeling so inspired and so just like, yes, that is how that story needed to be told. Like everything, like just a line of checks, you know, going down of like, that was amazing, that was amazing, that was amazing. And I didn't feel that at all leaving Killers of the Flower Moon. I felt a little bit excited to see some of my friends in it as mm-hmm. either extras or people in the background or whatever. And then like, I felt excited about, I thought the casting was really good and the performances were really yeah. good. Like Jesse Plemons knocked it out of the park. Obviously DiCaprio and De Niro are great. And of course, oh my God,
Lily Gladstone,
it's escaping my brain. Thank you. Lily Gladstone yeah. is fantastic.
She might win an Oscar on this one.
I hope she does. That would be so amazing. So yeah, the casting and the performances were outstanding. It was just like, I left the theater being like, okay, I survived, and I don't want to see that ever again. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's not exactly like the Native representation we've been asking for.
Yeah. So what, having gone to film school and, you know, the film school I went to, we very much kind of, I don't want to say fond, you know, inclusivity, but my class was almost entirely white. But we did things like land acknowledgments at the beginning and ending of our student films. Our professor asked us that we do that. You know, but at the same time, we were a film school that was, you know, had all white students, all white professors. That's actually changing now. What needs to be done for Indigenous representation in media? I mean, obviously things are changing and moving, not in the worst direction, but I still, like, when I found out Scorsese was making this, it's like, this is just not your story to tell. You can be an executive producer on this. You can put your money behind it. You can put your name behind it and elevate an Indigenous director, an Indigenous filmmaker. Why isn't that happening? And how would you like that to proceed, I guess, if that makes any sense?
Yeah, I think it is happening. I just saw Lakota Nation v. United States, which is a really fantastic documentary that had tons of support behind it and was really, really well done. And I think Mark Ruffalo is an executive producer. And then I forget who else, but it is happening in corners of the film industry. But on the large scale, I mean, this sounds really bad, but like some people just need to like retire or, not be in the industry anymore, because some people are just never, like, they think that all stories are their stories to tell. And as people who have different ideas about what this industry could look like or should look like come into power and have those resources that they're actually willing to share, you know, that's what's going to make it look different. And there's so many talented Indigenous filmmakers that just need funding for an idea that they've been sitting on for a long time, or maybe people who have a story to tell but don't exactly know, like, what it looks like to bring a film like into festival season, or, you know, get it into the right hands, or like don't have those connections. So I think at any level of filmmaking, from beginner all the way up, like there are opportunities to support Indigenous filmmakers at every level, whether they're just learning or whether they have ideas that just need to be realized. So I think it really just depends, but we're starting to see it, and I would love to see it more and more and more.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to start off with that, because I went and saw that film, and I was like, you and I had a few little conversations online about it. I really just want to get your take on that, how you felt about that industry and where things are going, because there's a lot of stuff happening. You know, Reservation Dogs has been pretty successful, and other things. So I just wanted to get your take on that before we talk more about you and what you've been up to with, you know, consulting now, and how, completely shifting gears, you work for the Department of Interior, which, if you know, you're outdoorsy, you've definitely stepped on land that is managed by the Department of Interior. The reason you weren't on the show is because you were working with the Department of Interior and you weren't quite sure on what you could not say and could not say, which was totally understandable. Working though, going from, you know, you passed the bar and you started working for the government, what was that experience like? I know there's things you can't obviously talk about, but I'm curious what that experience was like, working for a huge government agency, coming right out of law school, coming right out of the bar.
Yeah. I think I'm still processing it in some ways. It was at one point like exactly what I wanted to do, because I think as an Indigenous activist, and definitely as an attorney, you have to kind of choose what your path is going to look like, in the sense of being very anti-government, because we have a lot of reasons to be very anti-US government with the history in this country, or being not pro-government, but working for the government, which a lot of Native people do, and trying to make it more functional. Because as a Native person growing up in America, you're literally from the moment that you're born, you are interacting with the BIA, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, that has kind of like this power over you in a way that non-Native people will never experience or understand. Like you get, you have your birth certificate, and then you get a certificate of Indian blood, which has your degree of Indian blood on it. So mine says like my census number, which is kind of like a social security number for your tribe. And then it says, you know, one half Indian blood. And so it's like they're keeping track of how much Indian blood you have, which is just like such a strange thing. It's like we do that for dogs, horses, and Native people in this country. It's a really weird thing. And, you know, the purpose of that is that like the Navajo Nation, you're eligible for citizenship if you're one quarter Indian blood or more. So if you fall below that quarter line, so like for me, if I had a child with a non-Native or non-Navajo person, and then they had a child with a non-Navajo person, then like my grandchildren would not be eligible for Navajo citizenship, even though their parents are, and I am, like, we're all Navajo. But if you're, if you fall below that blood quantum, then you don't get to be a citizen of your tribe potentially anymore. And so it's like this weird kind of cloud you have hanging over you to of like choosing a partner and, you know, how you want your family lineage. Like, are they, are my children's children going to be eligible to receive services from Indian Health Services? Are they going to be eligible to have land on our homelands? Are, you know, all these questions that affect your family in perpetuity are kind of on your shoulders a little bit, which is a weird thing. So, that is a colonial construct, this idea of blood quantum. And so, you know, then going to Indian Health Services, which is like in our treaties with the US government, there was basically a trade for like, if we cede land, like if we just, if we say, okay, we'll just stay on our reservations, in exchange, we get education, we get healthcare, we get these other privileges. And that's why like the Indian Health Services exist. That's why the Bureau of Indian Affairs and Bureau of Indian Education exist, because we basically like bartered for like, if we decide to cede this land, then we get these things. And in reality, like we're getting bare minimum. Like they spend less on the healthcare for a Native person than they do a prisoner in the federal prison system, which is like problematic in multiple ways. Right.
Yeah.
But, it's like you have this experience in these interactions with the federal government throughout your life, because they're supposed to be offering services, but it's always frustrating and bureaucratic and, really, really like a hindrance to your life in so many ways. And so, then to go work for them, like you have all this, like all these ideas and resentments and experiences with the federal government throughout your life. And then you have to decide, like, do I spend my life fighting this system because it sucks? Or do I decide to go into this system to try to make it a little bit better and make other people's lives easier? And I just needed to see, like, I just wanted to join, work for the federal government to see what it actually looks like, and like, why is it so dysfunctional, and can it be better, or is it just so broken that it is beyond repair? We call it FUBAR, right? Mm-hmm. And so I worked for an oversight organization that is meant to basically hold the Department of Interior accountable. And in my mind, I'm like, that's perfect, because we know that the federal government has treaty responsibilities and trust responsibilities to tribes. It's like literally in the founding documents of our country that the Supreme Court has said that the United States has these treaty and trust responsibilities to tribes. And they, you know, as long as tribes exist, they the government will owe these provisions, like I said, like water rights, healthcare, basic provisions, like recognizing sovereignty, recognizing land rights, these sorts of things. And so in my mind, I was like, well, I can go to this oversight organization and they will, like, I will be able to help them hold the Department of Interior accountable to their trust and treaty responsibilities. And that will, like, make a greater force to make Indian country a little bit, make it easier to live in Indian country. But what I found was this oversight organization had never had a Native attorney. Oh, and wow. I was only the second Native person that they had ever had on staff since they became an agency in the 70s or 80s. And so it was a lot of educating from the very, very ground level, like educating attorneys who are, you know, 10, 20, 30 years my senior, who didn't know anything about Indian law. And I was like starting from like, this is the trust responsibility. This is a treaty. Like, these are agreements that the United States has with tribes, you know, and it was good. Like, you know, my supervisors were amazing. Some of my coworkers were so great. And it was good in so many ways just to like be the person who's there to educate them that those things exist and, you know, what those mean. But like, I felt like I was on step A, where like I went to law school to learn how to do step F through Z. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I felt like I was sort of spinning my wheels a little bit, that it's important work to do to start on step A with regulators and overseers who have no knowledge of Indian law. But like for me, I was like, I can't spend the next 40 years of my career, you know, however long I have in my career, I can't spend that like teaching people who should know better very basic things. And I felt really frustrated with that. And so I decided not to stay, not just because of that, but also because I got really great opportunities and I wanted to jump into these other opportunities and, you know, make something happen for myself, which feels yeah. really, really good.
I can only imagine that's got to be exhausting. I mean, not only at within what the job you were doing in for the government, but just in general, having to constantly be educating people who should know better. I mean, do you ever find yourself like, God damn, these white people, like, this is so obvious. Like, seriously, I can only imagine how exhausting. I've talked with gay friends and black friends who have said the same thing to me. Like, I'm so tired of having to educate, you know, straight people on gay culture. I'm so tired of having to educate my white friends on what it means to be black. I can only imagine it. There's probably some similarities there for you just constantly having to educate and just be like, just Google it, God damn it. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Especially people who have a legal obligation to know those things, you know, like that's the part that makes me, that made me really crazy. That felt too heavy for me was like the educating is exhausting for sure. But when you're having to educate people who have legal responsibilities to already know that, mm-hmm. Then you can see a direct link between these people not knowing that, even though they're supposed to, and your grandma back home who doesn't have heat and who's getting crappy healthcare, and your, you know, your cousin who is in a school system that is so underfunded by the Bureau of Indian Education, you know? And so like, I think it was a little bit too heavy for me because I understood those direct correlations of like, this matters so much. And everyone in this office is acting like it doesn't matter at all. And, or that it matters a little bit, but it's not our top priority because it's not a big moneymaker for the office or whatever. It's like, if they understood how much it mattered, if they like ever went to a reservation and like understood what they saw in the context of American government and history, then like their mindset would totally change. I guess I'm learning that I can't do that for people. Like I can't wave a magic wand and like make them understand why it's important to uphold a trust and treaty responsibility of the United States by, you know, funding healthcare and schools and broadband access and all these things correctly. Like it's a much greater job than I was able to accomplish in that role. And I also think I'm not giving myself enough credit, which my supervisors would tell me all the time, which is why they were really great, where they're like, you're doing great work. You know, this is really important work. And I know that, you know, education is so important. Mm-hmm. It's just like, I don't know if I just don't have the right sensibility about it, where I like have too much urgency behind it and I can't handle it or what, but yeah, I just found it really difficult.
I mean, just from long as I've known you, you've been educating, going on podcasts, doing things, you know, on YouTube, you know, producing. I think it was Vice News. You did the thing with. You've been doing so much work, and then do it, you know, I can only imagine on that level, you know, with these treaties that the U.S. government agreed to, and no one working for the government knows. I couldn't even imagine.
Yeah, it's brutal.
So what are these new opportunities that are coming?
Okay, so I have a grant called the Radical Imagination Grant from Indian Collective, which is this really awesome organization. They do a lot of advocacy. They do a lot of protests. They do their founders were very present at Standing Rock, and mm-hmm. I feel like they've just like fueled this organization with the fire in their bellies from their experiences there. But they're doing a ton of like community grassroots funding for artists and advocates of all backgrounds, you know, Native people. And so it's like the perfect intersection of art and policy, which is exactly what I want to be doing. So nice. I'll be creating more artwork that, you know, if you've seen my art, it's very politically fueled, where I try to sort of express some aspect of the Native experience through my art. And then the policy part is like this, you know, it's more educating. It's going to talk in different events and different settings and talk about like my work with broadband, talk about federal Indian law, talk about, you know, whatever it is. And then it also I'll be releasing more podcast episodes of my podcast Determination. So I've got to resurrect that in the next few months, and I'm excited to do it. It's daunting to think about because I remember it being so much work when I was doing it before, but
it was,
I'm also
so
really excited.
Good. It was
Thank
so good.
You.
I loved it.
Thank you.
I am super excited for you, especially with the policy and the political stuff and the art, bringing that together. Like, I think you have a way about what you do and can communicate. I want to hear more. I constantly want to hear more what you're doing and what you're working with, and you have your fingers everywhere. I'm just like, my gosh, like this is just amazing content. I debated on getting into this. And we've talked about this. I grew up, most of my listeners know, I grew up evangelical Christian Southern Baptist. I was a pastor for 15 years. I spent my summers on the Pima Reservation in Arizona with my grandparents. They were always, as older I got, the more they encouraged me, you need to help save the Indians. And, you know, I truly believe my grandfather, who has passed, did love the indigenous people he worked with. I truly believe that. Mm-hmm. But he was still, we call it ignorance or arrogance, I don't know. He was still trying to put white man's religion on indigenous cultures. And growing up, I didn't know what I didn't know growing up. And I look back, I'm like, wow. Like we were doing as Christians and as evangelicals and what, and I've seen, you know, we're sitting there trying to save people's souls. Yet, like you talked about on the reservation, there are people who don't have water, but they're mm-hmm. giving their 10% tithe to the church every week. And I'm like, you know, you can pay your water bill. Like,
right.
And I know you grew up similarly on the other side of that. And if you're down, if not, we can edit this out. If we want to explore that a little bit, because
I grew up on the white man's side. My grandfather is a missionary, a pastor, trying to put the Christianity on, you know, indigenous people in Arizona, where you were, you know, in the church growing up and that, going on mission trips, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to explore that, we haven't talked about that on air before. I just thought,
yeah, I have similar reservations about talking about it, but I think it's really important. So I do kind of want to get into it. Maybe we can just like tread lightly and like walk into this area and see what it feels like a little bit. I kind of was on the other side of it, but I kind of wasn't, because I grew up in the church in Farmington, which is a border town. It's not on the reservation, but it's right next to it. Mm-hmm. And the population is very much like white, Navajo, and Latinx and Hispanic. And it's really, I grew up in this church that I would say was mostly white. Like in my memory of it, I don't remember there being a lot of other people of color in that church at all. And we went when I was a kid, like pretty religiously, I guess that's the origin, like every Sunday. And then grew up in like Sunday school, hearing about David and Goliath and all that kind of stuff. And then we stopped going for a while when I was maybe in like middle school. And then I went back to it when I was 15. And then I was a new youth minister who kind of like drew me back into like all the youth programming and stuff like that. And we were going on mission trips as well. We would go down to New Orleans. And like, I think about that. I don't remember where I heard it, if it was a meme or what, but it was basically like, you know, you go there and you like give out these WWJD bracelets and they're like, cool, can I have like food and water? And it's like, no, but here's your WWJD bracelet. You know, like, can I have a sustainable economy or like affordable childcare? It's like, no, here's your WWJD bracelet. And so like thinking back on those experiences and like looking back at it now, understanding what I do about like colonization and racial equity and the harms that the church has inflicted upon people of color historically, not just in this country, but like, you know, looking at this country, it's really wild to think like how much of a part of my life Christianity was. And I really resonate with your posts that I know are really controversial on your page, but your posts where you're saying like, it's lonely to leave Christianity and you lose like part of your identity in a way, and you lose friends, and you instantly lose a whole community that your schedule revolved around for, you know, X amount of years in your life. And that's a lot to, that's a huge shift when you decide to walk away from the church. And I think it's happening a lot, you know, whether it's like people are like quiet quitting church, or whether they had like a huge shift in their life where they're like, I don't want to do this anymore. And then, you know, like, where are you now? So I guess like in the main thing that I wanted to just convey in chatting about this is that like, I see you in that, and anyone else who has gone through that or is going through that. Like, I think we both very much see them, because it's, for me, it's the best thing that ever happened to me. But it's also a really hard thing. And I think like it can be both, right?
Yeah. It's funny. I had, there's a point to the story. I posted what you were referring to. I had posted something in July about being lonely, and because I left the church at, you know, 36. You know, my wife said, I'm an atheist. I realized, oh, wow, I'm in a messed up system here. I don't really believe this. I'm just trying to get a paycheck at this point. I left, and I had posted basically, you know, I'm having to relearn how to do everything. And I look at my life. I see the progression of how, you know, my mind was changing. My paradigm was shifting very slowly. But I posted a post in July, and the evangelical community recently picked it up, and it's just going like, oh, there's just,
oh, really?
And so it went from like, you know, I posted in July, I think like in September, maybe at 20,000 views. It's up to 1 million now because it's just getting shared amongst evangelicals who are praying for me.
Oh, how kind of them.
Yes, yes. It's great. And I've been told horrible, terrible things in my DMs. But just that idea that it was described to me. I was on another podcast talking about this. It was actually a podcast about people who were leaving their faith. They invited me on. And something that was said to me really resounded with me is the reason, because I still struggle with guilt about leaving. Like, oh my gosh, like I left, mm-hmm. I betrayed him. And something that was very profound that was said to me is the reason I feel guilty is because I am betraying a system that for so long was built to lift me up. Mm-hmm. A system that was built to lift up white, straight, cisgendered men.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just, that blew my freaking mind. Like, oh my gosh. Like, yeah, like I couldn't, I just, something about that. I was like, wow, I really like, it just resonated. Like, wow. Like that, and then never really put into words that, yeah, this system I was a part of was built to lift me up, was built to mm-hmm. lift up whiteness, maleness, you know, straightness, you know, America.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just so profound to me. And then thinking back to, you know, my days growing up, you know, spending my summers in Arizona, like, wow, like we didn't do anything to help the people we were supposed to be preaching to. We weren't mm-hmm. doing anything to raise their quality of life. We weren't doing anything to hold the government to account, to keep to the treaties. And, you know, we were on our property on the reservation. It was a nice church that was built in there, a nice parsonage. My grandpa had the nicest house on the reservation.
Mm-hmm.
It just blows my mind. Like, wow, the system was made to lift up whiteness, straightness, maleness.
Mm.
And like, and I guess my point of that is just coming to grips with that. And then seeing how people are so vitriol against the fact that I said no, I'm literally walking away,
mm-hmm.
and like turning my back on it, and it's just a little caption of me walking towards the ocean. And that for me, like, has, and then to go and then turn around and be like, you know what, white people, we've screwed up a lot and we need to do something about this. And people just feel that I betrayed them, and people who you thought, you never thought had a racist bone on their body, and they're like, really? I don't know. It's been, mm-hmm. it's been an interesting journey. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think about reparations, like what reparations looks like for churches and for churchgoers. And like my brain goes straight to boarding schools, because I was saying in the treaties, you know, education is one of the things that the federal government had to provide. And the way that they did that was basically handing it over to churches and saying, like, can you guys handle this for us? And the churches were like, bet. And so they created these boarding schools that were like set up by the government, but then run by churches. And if you don't like know about what has happened in Indigenous boarding schools, you know, there's tons of information online, documentaries and testimonies of, we call them survivors. Most schools have graduates. We have survivors, because there was just mass sexual abuse, emotional abuse, physical abuse, spiritual abuse that was happening in these boarding schools. And not everyone had terrible boarding school experiences, but, you know, they're finding children's bodies in unmarked graves still under boarding schools or former grounds of boarding schools. And so there's really a mass reckoning happening in Canada and here around boarding schools and the trauma that Indigenous students endured at boarding schools. And so I think about like the role that religion and churches played in boarding schools and like what the direct result is in Indigenous people today. And I can think about this like directly with my family, because my grandparents were sent to boarding schools. My grandpa was put on a train. He lived in Oljeto, which is Monument Valley, Utah, mm-hmm. And then down in Arizona as well. And he was put on a train in Flagstaff. And I asked him about it like the year before he died. He died 2 years ago. And I asked him about it because I was like, if I don't ask him now, he might not want to talk about it. He might tell me to F off. But if I don't ask him now, then that's those stories are going to be lost forever. And so, you know, if he's willing to tell me, I want to listen. And he said that on the train, a lot of kids were crying. It was very dark. And then they went through tunnels and it got really smoky. And he said when they arrived in Oregon, which, you know, that's where he was, but he didn't even know Oregon. Like he had never lived mm-hmm. anywhere except the Navajo Nation and didn't speak English. And so he said when he got there, he was looking for the sun and the horizon to like get his bearings. And he went like this and he said, and the world had turned upside down. And it was like the sun was in a different place in the sky and the horizon because he had never been away from his homeland before. And so there is where they took the language away from them. And my dad is the first generation ever in our family that hasn't spoke Navajo. And so, you know, I don't speak Navajo. I took it in high school and college, but I'm not a fluent speaker. And my dad's not a fluent speaker because at the boarding school, they taught them, they often beat them for speaking their native language and they were only allowed to speak English. And so my grandpa and grandma never taught Navajo to their children because they were like, you guys need to speak English because that's the way the world is now. And like, mm-hmm. that's where we need to go. So like I was thinking the other day, I was like, regionally, it was all different churches. So you can like look up online. I found it once. I don't know where I found it, but there are reports, like government reports saying like, this is the church that was handling this boarding school. And this is the church that was handling this boarding school. So I don't remember which one was running Chamawa, which Chamawa boarding school is still a functioning, well, somewhat functional boarding. It's open boarding school in Oregon. And I'm like, I need to find out what church was running it and write them a letter asking for them to pay for Navajo language lessons for me and therapy. And like, that is the main reparations that like me as the granddaughter of a person who attended their boarding school. Like that's, I feel like that's those are the things that
generational effects.
That's how generational trauma has manifested in like, you know, just needing to feel okay and then needing the language back.
At what point growing up in the church did you say, I'm out?
I started going again, like I said, when I was 15. And then it was pretty much like the biggest part of my life from 15 to 18. So for, you know, a solid 3+ years. And then it was really a interpersonal issue. My youth minister was, in hindsight, like after much, much therapy, she was emotionally and spiritually abusing me and another girl for, you know, those 3 years. And so I had enough when I went to college, because it really culminated. Like she would tell us that, it was God's will for us to not have boyfriends and to, God's will for me to go to a Christian school in Texas, which is what I did. For my first year, I went to a Christian school in Texas. Cause I was like, well, if it's God's will, like, I don't want to mess with that.
The God card and trumps everything. Like when a leader in church tells you, well, God told me this for you, you're like,
totally.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I guess I have no say in the matter. If God told you, didn't tell me. I'm sorry, go ahead. I remember hearing that so much growing up.
Oh, like, yeah.
Oh, God told me this for your life. Okay.
Right. Like, who are we to question what God, exactly. And like, if it's a spiritual leader and like, they know more about connecting with God than I do. So yeah, I'm going to listen to them. So, I was set to go to a Christian school in Texas, and, I hadn't dated anyone all through, high school, because she told me it was my will, God's will not to, when in reality, what I think was happening was that she had not come out as gay. And I think that there was maybe some attraction, and she was very jealous of any time that my friend, who was also abused, or I spent with anyone else, but especially with men. And so by saying like, it's God's will for you not to have a boyfriend, and if you're strong, then you won't ever get married and you won't have a boyfriend. You'll stay single. Strong people stay single. And it just, you know, it was really confusing to me. And cause I was like going through puberty, and I was like boy crazy, and, you know, wanted to talk to boys. And like one in particular, I wanted to go visit him in Nashville, and she told me I couldn't. And I was like, well, I really want to. And so I went, and it became this whole huge thing. And she got really mad at me. I bought a plane ticket, and I was like, my parents said it's okay. And she was like, you're just going to go and get pregnant. Like, he doesn't care about you at all. And I was like, I don't think so. And I went, and she was so livid, and yelled at me in front of everyone at mission trip in New Orleans. And I was like, okay, well, I'm going to get on the plane. And so I went, and then we never really spoke again after that. Like, that was me leaving the church, was being like, I'm going to go see about a dude. And she was so mad. And I was like working for her. And so, you know, the job was done, our relationship was done, and I was done with church, which was highly problematic. Because like after the summer, I still had to go to this Baptist school in Texas, and I went there for a year, and I was like so angry at the church and everything and her. And I was there for a year, and then that was, and then I left that and was so lost after that, because it was like, you know, everything we discussed, like my entire life was like, who am I? What am I doing? I'm doing the same thing my grandpa did with my hands, like turning, like it got flipped upside down, you know? And, yeah, it was really, really difficult. And then unpacking the abuse and just the confusion of like, what was that? Like, what happened? And, when someone is like basically telling you how you're supposed to be living your life for, you know, 3 years, for you longer, but in like adolescent formative years, and then that just all goes away, you have to figure out like what you're supposed to be doing with your time and who you're supposed to become outside of the church. And that's a really, really hard thing to do.
How was that year in a Christian school? I mean, I look back at my Christian college experience. It's very toxic. I loved it at the time. It sounds like you were able to, while you were there, to be able to see it for what it was.
I was more interested in making up for lost time, you know, because under the youth minister's reign, like I never dated, I never smoked weed, I never had a sip of alcohol, like all of these things that a lot of my friends were doing in high school, which like maybe I never would have done those things anyway, because I was a student athlete and cared a lot about my grades and all that kind of stuff. But when I got to Baptist school, you know, I just did all of those things and was like, it's like just a little bit wild, but it was fun, you know, like I survived, and I sort of saw it for what it was, but I also didn't. I was just there, you know, like we had already paid for it. And I was like, well, I got to make the best of it, you know? And I think the thing that I really, that kind of sucks about it is that like a lot of my friends who went all 4 years to a school, like, and they have friends that they made freshman year or whatever, like, I don't really have that, because the people who I did meet some really wonderful people there who were my friends and, you know, some of my best friends even for years after. But like, then when you get married and I don't, but like when other people get married and have kids and everything, like our lives just went in such different directions. Yeah. And I think it's really hard to have a non-Christian friend when you're a Christian, because there's a lot of like praying for them and pitying them and like hoping that they're okay and like trying not to judge them, and like conversations are hard. And so, yeah, I think it's just those relationships that I made that aren't really in my life anymore. And, I want, like, on the tip of my tongue, it's like, it was a waste of a year, I want to say, but it really wasn't, you know. I'm glad that I had that experience in some ways, but I was also really glad to be done with it.
Yeah. Yeah. I know we could talk about this forever. I'm curious to know, what the school is in Oregon, being in Oregon myself and knowing.
Oh, Chamawa. It's one of the bigger boarding schools that has been around since the late 1800s, I want to say. And like I said, it's still an open boarding school. It's called Chamawa. It's in outside of Salem, I want to say, but I'm not sure that's correct.
I know the area. Okay.
Yeah.
The history here is with the indigenous people here. I mean, the U.S. Army just wiped them out and put them all into one reservation up north. And it's just to hear that, I had no idea that there were Indian schools where people were brought in from other parts of the country. I knew people like from where I'm at in Southern Oregon were brought up to like the Salem area and Portland area. That's just insane to hear.
Yeah. A lot of Navajos went up there were sent to Chamawa. And then, I don't really know where the cutoff line was, if it was like the Mississippi or, somewhere else, but, it's escaping me now. Carlisle Indian School is in Pennsylvania, and tons of Native people were sent over there, students. And then there's a lot in Oklahoma as well. And Carlisle is like, if you Google Indian boarding schools, like probably one of the first images that you'll see is like hundreds and hundreds of students in front of Carlisle Indian School. And, you know, they just like really prided themselves in like civilizing the savages and, you know, cutting off their hair and making them look white. And the motto was kill the Indian to save the man. Like if you kill the Indian inside, then, you know, their soul will be saved and they'll become more white.
I just found an article on one of the tribe sites here in Oregon.
This is to be continued, because I want to go see Carlisle Indian School. Like I've never been there. I've never been to Oregon before. And since my grandfather and my Nolly, my grandpa's sister were both there, like I'm really interested to see that place.
It's not drive up to 5. Wow. I thought I knew a lot about the indigenous history here, and there's learning more. Like it's
that's a big one.
It's a huge one. I was completely blind spotted by.
Yeah.
Wow. We can talk about this forever, but I know you have some questions or topics that you got.
Oh yeah, let's jump into. Maybe I got some more. So people were generally curious, you know. I think they remember that the last time I was on this was the hiker. It was called the Hiker Podcast.
Yeah.
So I got a few hiking questions. One of them was about outdoor funds, like how plugged into like resources, outdoor resources are you, of like if people can turn to like gear libraries or like funding for backpacking trips or anything like that, especially for BIPOC.
Oh gosh. It's a huge problem. And it's something I've talked about with so many, especially in the Black community. My friend Shalitha, who's been on the show before, she's just finished the CDT. She hiked the 18. She's going to hike the PCT here in a few years. That was the biggest thing for her, being a queer woman of color. This gear costs money. Mm-hmm. And there is no, I haven't found any programs. What she has done, she got with companies and, you know, hey, Lecky, could you sponsor me and give me some poles? And hey, Osprey, could you, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Which
not everyone can do. She has a following. So it's like, oh yeah, we'll do that. But it's in the outdoors, you know, you can sit there and say, oh, you don't need all the nicest, fanciest gears, but if you want to go backpacking, you need gear that's going to hold up.
Yeah. You want to be warm, and that's the most expensive stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I constantly remind how privileged I am that, you know, people just send me crap I didn't ask for. And I'm like, my favorite puffy coat is one I got at Ross for $30. And I have like my seven favorite others.
Yeah. Yeah. My favorite is the Goodwill puffy that I got in Tucson for like $1.
Yeah. And it's like,
yeah,
I'm thankful for it and it's great. And you know, it's nice to have new, nice things, but it's like, why can we somehow shift these resources to people who are in socioeconomic, you know, situations where they can't afford to drop $200 on a coat, $200 on trekking poles, $200 on a backpack, you know, mm-hmm. you know, $150 on shoes, you know, everything else that goes with that. So there's not. I know my university has, Southern Oregon University has an outdoor program where they've been trying to do that. There's been talks mm-hmm. about that. They've talked with me about that a little bit. But I don't feel like the will is there for a lot of people to mm-hmm. to do that. Unless you have a social media following. And then, oh yeah, we'll give you stuff. Just make sure you talk about it. Or, you know, we'll fund your through hike, which is great. I am super thankful for those sort of things. That's why I have a career now. But that economic barrier outside of just, you know, going for a, you know, a short hike, you know, around your house is huge for people who really want to get out and explore the outdoors and explore the lands around them.
Mm-hmm. I have an idea that may or may not come to fruition next summer, which is that I really want to do an overnight camping trip with, or like a backpacking trip, with Indigenous people in New Mexico, and like people who maybe haven't done it before, because mm-hmm. I remember how terrifying it was thinking about going on an overnight backpacking trip before I did my first one. And it just felt like, I don't know what kind of gear, like it, you know, it is high stakes in the sense of like, you could, if you're not prepared, you could either like at best spend a really uncomfortable night, or at worst, like really get hurt.
Yeah.
And so, I've been thinking about like leading a, backpacking trip for people's like first overnights. I actually did it with my friend Cheyenne. I did a vlog about it, so it's probably on YouTube somewhere. But we did, it was her first backpacking overnight, and we did Lake Catherine, which is this insanely beautiful lake up north of Santa Fe. And it was really, really cool to experience backpacking like through someone's first time. Like mm-hmm. I imagine, I hear parents say that about like their children, like that, you know, it's like their first time experiencing mashed potatoes or ice cream or whatever. And it's like, you get to watch it and it's really cool. But like, that's how I feel about taking newbies out for a backpacking trip. So potentially next year, that might be something that I'm planning. And maybe we can talk about like gear, if people are needing gear or whatever.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I like that idea a lot.
I mean, not just from the gear point of view, just, you know, getting out there, like you don't know mm-hmm. what to expect. You don't know who's a safe person out there, who's not a safe person, you know, when you're on the trail. I think that more things like that, gosh, would just be absolutely epic. And to get these gear companies to help support that, because in the end, I think it works for them, because you give them entry-level gear. Give anyone a new backpacker entry-level gear, when they're ready to really get into the sport of it, they will they will be more faithful to your company or whatever. It's a win for them, but ultimately it's getting people in the outdoors to realize how healing and amazing the outdoors are. I wish gear wasn't so expensive.
Yeah. I think for the indigenous community, like one of the things that I was thinking about a lot when I hiked the Colorado Trail was like the privilege of everything that I was seeing. I'm sure that I've talked about this before, but like those are all Ute homelands. Like I have a map in my office of like what the Ute reservation looked like as time goes on. And at one point it was like the entire western third of Colorado, like all the way up from the top to the bottom. And then like it, now it's tiny. It's like a little dot down by Durango, two little dots. And, but when I was hiking the Colorado Trail, I was thinking about the Ute people and how few Ute people were ever going to see the things that I was seeing and how few, like compared to how many, like, non-native backpackers were out there that were just like living it up. And not to say that they shouldn't be out there at all. Like, I'm glad that everyone is experiencing that because it's so beautiful, but, it just made me really sad thinking about, like, I love my homeland so much as a Navajo person and being on them and seeing more and more of them. And, the thought of like being a Ute person and not seeing that, made me want to figure out like what it would look like to get as many Ute people out there that want to be out there, you know?
Yeah. I like that.
So yeah, that's how I think about like homelands and hiking and specifically for like Pueblo people or Navajo people in Santa Fe. That's kind of my thought of like, I want everyone who wants to, who's able and wants to get out there, to experience it. Cause it's just so beautiful and amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. Wish there was more ways to get past that. Yeah, I think it's just going to take those of us who see the problem just be like, all right, let's do something about it and stop waiting for other people to do it.
Yeah. I think the main thing is like, I just need a really good liability waiver. Cause when I think about it, my lawyer brain is like, am I responsible for them? I kind of am, but I don't want to be, I don't know. You know, so.
That's how I think about with like group hikes and stuff. It's like, Andy, do a group hike. I'm like, if you get hurt, am I gonna, okay. I need to find like a boilerplate something just to,
I know I'm a lawyer. I can figure it out. We'll just, whoever wants to sign their life away to come hiking with us, we'll do it.
Exactly. Yeah, my friend Jenny Brusso, actually, when she does her group hikes with unlikely hikers, she has you sign a waiver, basically saying you're an adult, you make your own decisions, and you can't sue us.
Yeah, don't sue me.
What else do you have on the questions there?
We have, are you a big music guy?
I was a musician for a long, part of what I was a worship pastor, so kind of.
This was just my friend being cheeky, but he asked our favorite punk record.
Oh, my punk record. Oh, punk. Probably. Oh, gosh. MXPX back in the 90s.
Oh, whoa.
That dates me. Long time. Yeah.
That's a throwback. So the least cool thing about me, I know everyone's like, oh my God, Dara is so cool. The least cool thing about me is that I know so little about music. Like I enjoy music. Every time music's on, I'm like, oh, this is good. Or I don't like this or whatever, but I know so little. I've actually gotten in fights in past relationships for how little I know about music because it's just like, not something. It's like my brain won't remember like who sings certain things or like, it's like my brain is like, it's like I got all of the analytical sort of stuff, but nothing that applies to music. Not that like music isn't analytical, but my brain is just like, who sings this again? Like, who is this again? Yeah. I have no idea. So yeah, I've got nothing for the music people. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. I had a phase in like late high school where I was into punk music. So that was it. Went to a few punk shows when I lived in Las Vegas, but that was really into Christian music, obviously, for a long time. But
I think that's part of what did it was like in those formative years of high school, I was listening to freaking like Reliant K and David Crowder and Charlie Hall. And like, those
I've
are
met
the things
all
that I
of
know.
Them. I have met and had conversations with all those people, especially Charlie Hall and David Crowder. Oh my God. You know, Charlie Hall, that's actually, I spent some time with Charlie Hall in outside of, in Glorieta, New Mexico, outside of Santa Fe.
Were we at the same youth camp? Because that's where I saw Charlie Hall. I think he was at the Glorieta youth camp, which is where we went. That I and went, Fort Lewis College.
Oh my, yeah. I went to Glorieta a lot.
Whoa.
It was a collegiate week I saw Charlie Hall. I was in my mid-20s, maybe early 20s. Yeah. Yeah. That was, spent a lot of time at Glorieta. Wow, that's weird that you were there. You know, I just realized you probably know where that is.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I see the sign, you know, going to Santa Fe. And every time I'm like, God, it's so beautiful. But I hate what I was there for. But it is such a beautiful place. Yep.
Yeah, I went there like 2 years in high school and like 4 years in college for conferences.
Crazy.
And camps. Yeah.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize. I guess that makes sense that like people come from all over to go there. But like for us, it was like 3 hours away, you know, so it was like, yeah, of course we're going to that place.
We would do the 12-hour drive. Last year there, I was actually there to recruit people to go on mission trips. So I flew in, the mission agency flew me in and put me in a nice room there. I'm like, oh, we're not staying in the crappy cabins. This is great.
Yeah. Yeah. I always stay in the crappy cabins.
I did that in high school. It was always the crappy cabins. Oh, wow. That's funny.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a blast from the past.
But yeah, music, I don't know. I was really into music. Obviously being a musician, but it was all Christian. And now I'm just kind of like, I find myself not like knowing what to listen to.
Yeah. Well, thankfully
for such a long time.
Yeah. My boyfriend has one of the biggest record collections I've ever seen. And, I have been slowly trying to learn. Like, I feel like I'm learning like a new sport or something, and I'm really bad at it, which I hate being bad at things, but I'm like slowly trying to, I'll just like pull a record off the shelf and give it a listen and then like try to understand like the context of that record, you know, like where they're from and what was going on in the world when they were making it and stuff like that. And I'm like slowly working through to try to become slightly less stupid about music. It's going to literally be a lifelong process. But I was listening to Stone Roses, which I learned is a Manchester band from the 80s, and I like them. And then last night I was listening to the Dead Kennedys, and they are also an 80s band, and I did not like them. So that's how far I've gotten in the last 2 days.
All right. Any other interesting inquiries, if we have time? I know we're over. I know we are
over. Most of it was fine. About hikes in New Mexico, outdoor equity organizations, and the punk question. Yeah, that's, I think that's pretty much like everything that I was hoping to talk to you about. You know, I think we, the religion conversation has, there's so much more we can say. And if people are interested, like maybe we can follow up about it and talk a little bit more about it. Mm-hmm. Or if they're like, that was terrible, I never want to hear you guys talk about that again, then that's totally fine too. And then, the other thing that I wanted to say, like, cause in thinking about like how I wanted to approach this conversation, like, I really just wanted people to feel seen, one on the leaving Christianity thing, but then two, like on the hiking part, I did not hike this year at all, hardly. I didn't do any backpacking trips, and I think I went on like one day hike, and part of it was like just the stress of changing jobs and everything. But like, I think that there's probably people in your listenership who used to be really outdoorsy in the past, and maybe they haven't so much lately. But like, it kind of like, same with the identity sort of thing. Like when you're doing something a lot, it kind of becomes part of your identity. Yeah. And then if you're not doing that thing anymore, like it makes you kind of question that. And I guess I just wanted to like put a reassuring word like that I've kind of been trying to hold this summer out into the world a bit as well, which is like, I keep reminding myself, like, I am still a backpacker and I'm still a hiker, even though I didn't do it very much this year, that like it still gets to be part of like a cool thing about me and something that I do and part of my story, because I feel like I like beat myself up for not being able to do it, or like I'm not allowed to claim that as part of who I am anymore, or whatever. And I'm like, no, I'm not doing that.
Yeah, I totally relate to that, because this summer I wasn't able to go backpacking at all. I went camping like twice, hiked because literally the hiking I did because I had obligations to companies to create content. So I go to the closest trail where it looked outdoorsy. But, you know, I had a mental health crisis with my son all summer, and I just couldn't leave him alone. So I couldn't go for 3-4 days. And it's just that immense guilt you felt like, oh, you know, I'm anti-films and hikes, but I'm not, you know, I'm not out there hiking every day like I should be. I'm not, you know, we're literally, I mean, for a long time, I would go on hikes every day because it's like, wow, I'm getting paid to do this. This is my whole personality. And I'm like, wow, I'm still a hiker, but, you know, it's okay to not go on a hike. It's okay to go in a few weeks, a few months, or a few years without having set foot on a trail. It doesn't take away from how the outdoors has affected you and how it's left its imprint on you. It's so funny. I know it's social media that totally like just, you keep seeing all the stuff in your feed and like, oh, well, I'm not out there. I'm such a poser. I'm not, you know, doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And yeah, I like that a lot.
Yeah. And there's like, cause I missed it. Right. Like it was especially during wildflower season because it's so short up in really high elevations. And so like come June, you know, I was like, I planned to get out there and then I just like couldn't make it for, I had some health issues and stuff. And so I like, it just wasn't happening and I was missing it. And I was like watching the wildflowers die in front of my eyes and until they were gone. And then I was like, that's the one thing that happens like once a year and it's gone. And now I'm sad about it, you know? So I've like just kind of had to be like, I'm still a hiker, even though I missed wildflower season and I, you know, I don't have to give away all my gear and like turn in my hiker card and kind of just have to like find it in my own way again. Cause I also find that after the hikes that I've done, you know, I walked 1400 miles in China in 2015 and I walked the Colorado Trail in 2020, which is about 500 miles. And, my knees, like I really need to focus on the health of my knees because they do not like me anymore. I'm 32 and already they're like, no, we don't want to, like the thought of trail running right now is like, oh, like it sounds like it hurts so bad. So I think I really need to give some love and attention to my knees. And that kind of might've been part of it this year of like why thinking about going on, you know, a 13 mile hike or something was like painful to think about. And so I just didn't do it. And so I think I need to like think about that more for next year of what does it look like to focus on like my joint health going into hiking season so that I don't have all these like mental blocks and, you know, just overall health so that I'm not having health issues during my favorite time of year as well.
Yeah. It's funny how that when you haven't been hiking for a while, all of a sudden it's like, oh, it's 5-6 miles. I've done 20 miles in a day. That's nothing. You're like, no, it's not today.
I think that's part of it too, though, because when I was hiking the Colorado Trail, I was doing marathon days. And the thought of that now sounds really painful, but it also makes me like almost not want to go on a 3-mile hike even more, or even a 1-mile hike or whatever, because like, I know that I'm capable of so much more. And so it almost like, I convinced myself that it's like a waste of time to do anything less than a marathon, which is like so dumb, you know, it's just a hindrance to my own serotonin fix and happiness to, you know, have these unrealistic expectations for, you know, what I want my experience to be like. So there's all kinds of weird psychology around it, but, we don't have time for any of that. Like, we just need to get out there and have enjoyable experiences outside, even if it's just sitting on your back porch.
Yes. Just go on. This morning I just sat by the river for a half hour. Nice. Just like, wow, this is awesome. You know, and that's okay. And just to take that in and watching the leaves turn here in Oregon is freaking beautiful right now. And
that sounds amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean this when I say you're my favorite guest, because I usually prepare like a bunch of stuff for guests and have research done. And I'm like, I literally just emailed you last night. I'm like, all right, whatever. Here's a link. Let's chat.
Yeah.
And, you know, another guest, I'm like trying to get to 45 minutes. And now it's like, we're trying to like keep it under 90 minutes.
Yeah. We should probably wrap it up. But how many followers and listeners do you think we lost with this conversation?
I don't know. Probably
100, 200, 1,000.
That would be big. That'd be good. That's a good goal to set.
All right. We'll see if we can get to 250.
I don't know why I feel surprised when I see that happen, though. Whenever you sound off on anything that is remotely political, or, you know, I don't think it's political. It's just like freaking, you know, this is common courtesy, common human decency, you know, to acknowledge the past or acknowledge, you know, hey, you know, these things happened. Mm-hmm. We can acknowledge them, you know. It just rubs people the wrong way.
I think we grow up with an understanding. I don't know who said it, maybe John Trudell, that like to exist in America as a Native person is inherently political. Like, it's just part of the experience. And like I was saying with the CIB and your life being so influenced by federal policy, like, it's, you can't not exist politically. Like, your existence literally is political because of the policies that were trying to prevent it and then failed. And so now there are policies to, you know, govern it, us in whatever ways. And so, yeah, it is political, for better or for worse. It definitely is political. And then it's just a process of like figuring out what that means, because every American has an experience with that as well, whether they're aware of it or not, like, you know, how the land that they're on and having some kind of awareness. And I think that is one thing coming back, let's bring it full circle, the Killers of the Flower Moon, like, at its very base, what it's good for is giving general population Americans that reminder of like the Native people were here and this is part of what they experienced, you know?
Yeah.
And if it's just that, like, fine, we'll take it. Just having, if you're aware at all of like that history, in America, you know, that literally the land that you're standing on right now has been politicized in so many ways throughout the last couple hundred years. So, it is political, and I understand why people have a hard time with it. I have a hard time with it. I just, you know, I stick with it because I don't have a choice, but it is challenging. And so, like, I get it for people who reject it, but I also feel like the people who reject it hard, like, they have the most, let's say, they have high potential to also like understand the issues and like hopefully come back around later in their life to be like, oh no, like, that I was feeling that because it actually is really important, and like the public school system failed me and I didn't want to believe it, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's possibility. I don't give up on anybody that easily. So thanks if you stayed through the whole conversation, because that was probably not easy to hear me like talk about how bad I am at music and how you're on Native land and and how the church is a really challenging thing for people. But I think we did
get a
hold
of you as far as on social media, all that jazz.
Yeah, they can find me on Instagram, at Blackwater Soul is my handle. They can also find me on X, formerly known as Twitter, under the same handle.
You're still there?
I use it for like papers that have been published, and you know, like all my academic kind of stuff. Yeah, I find that those are those are well received there. And I don't really know a lot about, I guess people boycotted it and I get it, but yeah, I just kind of kept rolling with it. So
awesome. Thank you so much for coming on and for everything you're doing and just for your friendship. I appreciate it more than you know.
Absolutely. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Yes. So if you stuck through that entire conversation, thank you so much. It is greatly appreciated. I think as you listen to the conversation, you hear that we have a great time talking, and I was super excited to have her on again, and we'll probably have her on the show again. She's actually doing consulting for artists right now as an attorney. She's doing amazing things, and I'm just so happy for her, and I'm happy for just where her career is going, and just it's exciting to watch. So thank you all so much for listening all the way through. I thought about splitting this up into two episodes, but this was supposed to go out in December, so I just wanted to get it out. And thank you so much for sticking with the entire episode. If you'd like to listen to more, make sure you subscribe, leave a review wherever you're listening. If the platform you're listening on so allows you to leave a review, that helps so more people can find this show. Also, make sure you follow Dara everywhere. You know, you can go to blackwatersoul.wordpress.com. You can find her website there. All of her links, everything. I would encourage you to just follow along with what she's doing. She's doing some amazing things. I'm so happy for her. And you can follow me. I'm at Andy Films and Hikes on all the various social media networks, except I am not on X or Twitter or whatever we're calling it now. It's because I'm on Threads. If you don't follow me on Threads, follow me on Threads. Anywho, thank you all so much for taking the time to listen. Tune in next week. I'm super excited for next week's episode. Should I tell you all what it is? Should I tell you all? Should I? I have a photographer and a content creator on the show, an outdoor content creator and photographer. Super excited to share with you all. Anyways, with that, thank you for listening to this week's episode. Let me try that again, everyone. I don't do much editing here. I really don't. As you can tell from this episode, I only did minimal editing. I'll try that again. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Adventure Is Out There podcast.